Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, friend, and welcome. Welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast, a part of the Agora Podcast Network and the original Tudor Podcast, celebrating 15 years of Tudor podcasting this year. I am your host, Heather Tesco. I am very happy to be here with you. I'm very happy you are here with me. And March is, of course, Women's History Month. So we are going to be focusing all month on stories of women, particular women, life cycles of women. And we're going to be doing this both here on the podcast and on my YouTube channel, which you can check out. I'll put a link in the show notes. And we're just going to be focusing on all kinds of things having to do with women this month. So that will be fun and feminine and everything like that. Today, we are talking the life cycles of Tudor women. So basically, going through each phase in a Tudor woman's life and talking about it, because there were some changes between what women in the 16th century experienced during their lives and what I have experienced and what my peers have experienced in the 21st century. So we're going to talk about that a little bit and what was going on for women during each phase. First, though, I want to thank the new members and patrons of this show. Welcome, welcome to Roberta, Robin, and Jennifer, who joined on Patreon. I'm so happy to have you here. Members receive extra episodes, mini courses, depending on what level you're at, author chats, live author chats. We just did one with Janet Wertman, which I will be posting sooner. Maybe I've already posted it, depending on when you listen to this, and other fun perks. Also, same thing on YouTube. Thank you and welcome to my newest YouTube members. If you're listening to this on YouTube, you can just go ahead and click join this channel to get the same perks and fun things. Welcome to Allison and Beverly on YouTube. I'm so glad that you are here. The most recent course that went out for members, audio mini course, was on Henry VII and the consolidation of power. And I'm working on the next one for this month as well. So I will announce that when it's ready. All right, let us get into it. Of course, the Tudor period was a transformative period in English history, marked, like we talk about on this show, by significant cultural, political, and religious changes. The lives of women were obviously intricately woven into the society, but sometimes it was in the shadow of their male counterparts. And that's something I talked about this on my YouTube channel, too. A lot of times we just don't have records of what women were doing during this time because they weren't doing public things that were recorded. So they weren't necessarily at guild meetings like their male counterparts, where there might have been notes of what was discussed. They weren't in parliament. They weren't doing those kinds of public sphere things that would have been recorded. However, by the end of the century, we do start to see more letter writing. We start to see more diary keeping. So we do get more of a sense of it by the end of the century. But in the beginning of the century, there just aren't a lot of records. There's birth records, death records. Every once in a while, there are letters like the Paston letters during the Wars of the Roses. So there are just hints, but compared to what we can tell about the male counterparts, just not as much. Understanding the life cycle of a Tudor woman offers a window into the complexity of her existence, revealing not only the limitations imposed by her gender, but also the ways in which she navigated and sometimes subverted these constraints. The societal context of the Tudor period was heavily influenced by the patriarchal norm. Women's roles were largely defined by their relationships with men. They were daughters, they were wives, they were mothers. However, this does not mean that women were just passive actors in their lives. From the highest ranks of royalty to the humblest peasant families, women exerted influence, showed resilience, and made significant contributions to their families and communities, obviously. But delving into the life stages of a Tudor woman sheds light on the varied experiences that shaped her identities, the rites of passage that marked her transition from one stage of life to another, and the societal expectations that guided her path. So let's talk about the early stage, childhood and education. The journey of a Tudor woman, let's just call her Margaret. The journey of Margaret began when Margaret was born, an event that was fraught with danger for both mother and child. Childbirth was a purely female domain. Midwives played a crucial role, and the high infant mortality rate meant that baptisms were conducted swiftly, often within days of the birth, to ensure the child's spiritual safety. One interesting factoid is that midwives actually were granted the power of baptism. So they were actually able to baptize children and babies. And that is because often it would be clear that a baby wasn't going to survive, or maybe the mother was passing and it was clear the baby wasn't going to make it. And so a midwife would be able to do an emergency baptism to make sure that that child's soul would actually go to heaven. So I think that's a pretty cool little factoid that midwives could baptize. Naming customs frequently honored relatives or godparents, creating a sense of continuity and connection within families. So Margaret's early years would have been nurtured within the confines of the family home, where she would have learned skills and virtues expected of her gender. Daughters of nobles and the wealthy were educated at home by tutors, learning to read and write, a privilege not afforded to many of their lower class counterparts. Because women were expected to be able to manage an estate while the husband was away, Margaret, if she was upper class, would have learned even mathematics, rudimentary addition and subtraction, so that she could have been able to run the estate if she was being raised to be able to take on that role later in life. If Margaret was a girl of lesser means, education was centered on practical skills necessary for managing a household, such as sewing, cooking, and other domestic tasks. Despite these class distinctions, the underlying expectation was the same: to prepare a girl for her future role as a wife and a mother. As a girl approached puberty, her education and societal interactions became more focused on preparing her for marriage, the cornerstone of a Tudor woman's life. Again, if Margaret was in the upper echelon of society, this might include instruction in languages, music, dance, skills designed to make her more appealing in the marriage market. For a girl of a lower social standing, the transition to adolescence involved taking on more responsibilities within the home or apprenticeships in trades deemed suitable for women, such as dressmaking or brewing. Throughout these early stages of life, Tudor girls were molded by the expectations and realities of their world. So now let's talk about that marriage and Margaret's life from puberty to, say, her late 20s, early 30s. Marriage was not a personal choice, but a strategic alliance that could elevate a family status. And we talked about that during Love Month as well. It would also forge political alliances and ensure economic security. The transition from girlhood to womanhood was often marked by marriage, which was expected to occur shortly after reaching puberty, especially among the nobility and gentry. However, this did vary significantly with social class. Noble women married much earlier because they were doing so to secure alliances, while those of the lower classes actually married much later, not that much earlier than where we might consider it appropriate to marry. And that was often because, say, the man was still doing an apprenticeship and needed to finish that up, which would take him into his early to mid-20s. So marrying for the lower classes was later, in the late teens to early, even mid-20s. And that was, again, driven by economic necessity rather than political strategy. Arranged marriages were the norm, particularly among the nobility and gentry, where marriages were negotiated by families with meticulous consideration of dowries, jointures, and the social and political advantages such unions could bring. An example of the complexities involved in these negotiations can be seen in the arrangements made for Margaret Dakins, who became Lady Hobie. She was 18 when she married Walter Devereux, and it was orchestrated by a network of familial and political connections, emphasizing the role of marriage in consolidating wealth and influence. The negotiations were so intricate that contributions from various parties were meticulously planned to secure the young couple's financial foundation, which was a common practice, of course, in Tudor marriages. So let's say our Margaret was getting married. Her marriage would have been, of course, steeped in tradition like ours are today and religious ceremonies, with the practice of crying the banns and the exchange of vows and rings in a church setting. So you would cry the banns 3 times, and that was just making a public announcement. That was saying, we're going to get married. We are announcing that we're going to get married. You did that 3 times so that if anybody had an issue, say there was a pre-contract or anything like that, it gave time for people to come forward and say, no, this marriage can't actually happen because of whatever reason. If you were in a rush, say there was an unplanned pregnancy or something like that, you actually could get permission to avoid crying the banns, but you needed to have special permission for that. The weddings of nobility and gentry were lavish affairs, of course, reflecting the family's social status, while those of lower classes were simpler, but of course no less significant in their communal and social implications. Once she was married, a Tudor woman's primary role was to manage the household and bear children. Lady Hobie's diary entries provide a fascinating insight into the daily life of a woman at the helm of a large household and estate. Her entries detail not only her devout religious practices, but also her diligent management of household tasks, from tending to the sick to overseeing the harvest, reflecting the broad spectrum of responsibility that Tudor wives held. Through her writings, we see a woman embodying the era's ideals of obedience, piety, and industriousness, while also navigating the complexities and challenges of her role with resilience and pragmatism. So now let's talk about motherhood and family life. I did do a whole episode on pregnancy and childbirth in medieval and Renaissance England, and I actually did a course on it, a mini course a couple of years ago, which you can get. Actually, you can buy at my courses page, which is courses.heathertesco.com. So we're not going to go too deep into that. I will put in the show notes the episode that I did on pregnancy and childbirth, and also the course that I did, because I'm fascinated by it. It was also during a period when I had just had my own baby, so I was like super interested in that. Anyway, so the journey to motherhood in the Tudor period, of course, was fraught with peril and uncertainty. You know, they would say men died in wars and women died in childbirth. There was a lack of modern medical knowledge, obviously, meant that many women did not recognize their pregnancy until the quickening, or the first movement of the fetus, which is typically around 24 weeks or so. Diagnostic methods were rudimentary at best, relying on the color and characteristics of urine. There were no reliable means to monitor babies' well-being, things like eclampsia, blood pressure, all that kind of stuff. They weren't going to be able to test for that. The role of the midwife was crucial, as those experienced women were the main source of support and knowledge for the expectant mother, guiding her through a process that was both a natural part of life and a significant risk to her health. Childbirth did not discriminate. It was a perilous time for all women, as even Queen Jane Seymour found out, sadly, irrespective of her social standing. The private nature of childbirth, coupled with the high mortality rates for both mothers and babies, highlights the fragility of life during this period. The birthing process was shrouded in secrecy and was heavily influenced by religious beliefs, with women relying on amulets, prayers, and the intercession of saints like Saint Margaret to aid in the delivery. The reliance on midwives and the absence of male physicians, except in dire circumstances, underscored the gendered nature of childbirth, the reliance on shared female knowledge and experience. I will, however, say that this was changing during the 16th century. So one of the things that I find sad and also kind of ironically funny is that during the kind of Protestant Reformation under Edward VI, they actually made it illegal for women to pray to saints during childbirth. I'm not sure how you police that, but it was, you know, you could pray to God, but you couldn't pray to specific saints. Also, things like having any kind of amulets, having anything that was popish at all, you weren't allowed to have. So as a woman was getting ready to enter labor, if the local church had had something as a relic or an icon, they would want that. At Burton-on-Trent in Staffordshire, a pregnant woman was very desirous, they say, to have the staff of Saint Modwina to lean on during labor. Others had statues or tapestries or prayer rolls to help them focus. For centuries, women believed in the benefits of using birth girdles. So at Westminster Abbey, the monks guarded the Virgin Mary's very own birth girdle, given to them by Edward the Confessor. Not sure how he got it, but it was available to rent for noble and royal births. But of course, the Reformation brought with it the destruction of idols, and these potential tools were taken away from women. In 1538, the Bishop of Salisbury gave instructions that midwives in his diocese were not to use girdles, purses, or measures of Our Lady or other superstitious things. Some were told they could no longer pray to their saints, like I said. I think it's kind of hilarious that they thought that they could police that, but I don't know what it would have been like. Maybe they did. I can imagine a woman in labor crying out to St. Margaret and the midwife being like, no, you can't say that. So anyway, so that was pregnancy and childbirth. But of course, surviving childbirth was just the beginning. Raising children in the Tudor period involved nurturing them through the high-risk infant years, educating them according to their gender and social class, and preparing them for adult roles. Mothers played a central role in imparting the moral and religious values. Mothers were also very much involved in planning marriages. They also ensured that their children acquired the skills necessary for their future, be it managing a household or learning a trade. The education of a child was a reflection of their parents' aspirations and the practicalities of their social standing. If a woman lost her husband during this time and was a widow, that, of course, would bring significant economic and social changes for the woman, fundamentally altering her role within the family and society. A widow might find herself solely responsible for managing the estate and making decisions for her family's future, roles traditionally held by men. This shift could grant a woman a degree of autonomy and authority that she had not previously experienced, but it also came with the burden of maintaining the family's economic security and social position. So now let's move on to our fictional Margaret and her maturity and involvement in public life as her children start to grow and she's in her 40s to say her late 50s or so, becoming a matriarch. If Margaret has survived this long, older Tudor women wielded considerable influence within her family. They were often the glue holding the family together, arbitrating disputes, ensuring the continuity of family traditions and values. Their homes could become the centers of familial power, where marriages were arranged, alliances were forged, and the social education of the younger generation was conducted. Grandmothers, in particular, played a crucial role in the upbringing of grandchildren, often taking over their care during the parental absences or illnesses, and giving them wisdom and knowledge that they had accumulated. An example of this could be seen in the Dowager Duchess of Norfolk during the early Tudor period. This often gets a bad rap because there wasn't a lot of discipline, but she was the head of a large household, provided education and guardianship for several young women, including Catherine Howard. Her household was a microcosm of Tudor court life, where young women were trained in the skills and graces needed for advancement at court under the eye of a powerful matriarch. Like I said hers is not necessarily the best example, but it is the most famous. Older women often found a more public voice in religious and community affairs, using their status to engage in acts of patronage and charity. If they had been, say, married to a man who had been in a guild, they could take over some of his roles in the guild. So there are cases of, you know, women joining guilds. It's very rare, but it does happen. And the religious upheaval of the Tudor period, with its shift from Catholicism to Protestantism, provided new opportunities for women to express their faith and influence their communities through religious patronage and the establishment of new religious houses. Lady Margaret Beaufort, mother of Henry VII, of course, is a prime example of this kind of influence. Despite the constraints placed upon women, her role as the king's mother granted her considerable authority, which she used to become a major patron of educational and religious institutions. She founded Christ College and St. John's College in Cambridge. Her actions not only demonstrated her personal devotion, but also set a precedent for women's involvement in the promotion of education and religion. And like I said before, while the public sphere was largely dominated by men, widows and unmarried women in the Tudor period could and did engage in business and trade. The law allowed widows certain rights to their husbands' estates, which could include running their business. So this period saw women managing inns, trading goods, even participating in the international trade networks that were expanding during this period. One example of this is Catherine Fenkel, who was known for managing her late husband's business after his death. She was a successful merchant. After her husband's passing, she took over his mercantile business and continued to operate it with considerable success. And there's actually a book called The Working Life, The Working Life of Women in the 17th Century that was put out by the London School of Economics. And it's actually in the public domain now, so you can read it on Project Gutenberg. And it's fascinating. It's a fascinating study of how women in the 16th and 17th centuries worked and what professions they were in. So it goes into all different kinds of areas: textiles, agriculture, capitalist, crafts and trade, different professions women could be in. And again, I will add that to the show note too. I highly recommend that if you really want to dig deep into working women in the 17th century. So now our fictional Margaret is becoming an elderly woman in Tudor society, and she now occupies a very unique position. On one hand, older women were often revered for their wisdom and experience, playing a pivotal role as family matriarchs and advisors, like we talked about. On the other hand, societal norms that valued women primarily for their fertility and physical prowess could render older women invisible or marginalized. Yet many elderly women leveraged their age and experience to assert a degree of authority and influence that was less accessible in their youth. One example of the reverence for older women can be seen in Elizabeth Fitzgerald, the Countess of Lincoln, who stayed at court, remained a significant figure at court even into her late 60s, was respected for her wisdom and experience, and her home was a center of literary and cultural gatherings, illustrating the respect and agency that could come with age. The drafting of wills was a crucial aspect of ensuring the continuation of family lines and the proper distribution of one's estate, reflecting the emphasis on lineage and inheritance. Elderly women in particular used wills not only to distribute their worldly goods, but also to express personal wishes, support charitable causes, and influence family dynamics beyond their lifetime. Looking at Margaret Beaufort again, we see a compelling example. Her will meticulously detailed the distribution of her possessions, provisions for her servants, donations to charitable causes, illustrating her keen awareness of her legacy and the power of her estate to influence and support future generations and public welfare. One illustrative reflection can be found in the writings and accounts surrounding women like Lady Anne Clifford. Lady Anne Clifford was a Stuart noblewoman. You can actually read her diaries. They were published about 20 years ago. There's a paperback book. Her diaries and her correspondence penned in her later years provide not only a record of her efforts to reclaim her inheritance, but also her reflections on her early life, the challenges she faced, and her contributions to her family and society. Throughout the life stages of a Tudor woman, from the innocence of childhood to the wisdom of old age, We've talked about the societal roles and personal experiences that defined her existence. Each phase was marked by its own set of expectations and challenges, showcasing the resilience and adaptability of women in a period of significant historical upheaval and change. And one thing I want to say is that obviously men would have had their own set of expectations and challenges, particularly around fighting and war and economics and managing all of that. And so I don't want to discard that. However, it is Women's History Month. I myself am a woman. I am the mother of a future woman. And so this is of more interest to me. So it's funny because every once in a while I look at reviews of my show. I don't look that often because honestly, I'm not going to change anything based on strangers on the internet and what they think about me. So I really don't look that often. But I was redoing my website recently and I wanted to grab a review just to put it up. And so I looked, and it's so funny, the people who don't like me and who say things like she's become feminist and her show is nothing but a feminist propaganda and stuff like that. And like, it just kind of cracks me up because yes, I am going to talk about women more because like I am one and I have a daughter and I'm very interested in that. So I'm going to talk about the things that are of interest to me. It's certainly nothing against men. I'm a big fan of men, too. I'm married to one. I have a father. I have stepbrothers. So I certainly don't mean any of this to disparage men. Men had their own set of expectations, as they still do to this day. Similarly with women having their own set of expectations. And while I do enjoy talking about that with my husband and hearing his take on the societal expectations of men, especially because we tend to have somewhat reversed gender roles in that I am the main breadwinner for the family. And then he is mostly the primary caregiver for our daughter. So it's funny when we talk about that kind of stuff, because it is interesting to hear his take on things and what that's like for him and to share all of that. I don't mean any of this as disparagement towards men. So I want to make sure that that is clear, because I feel like somebody's going to pick up on this and say, oh, Heather's doing this because she doesn't like men, which is like completely not true. So there we go. I have said that. All right. We will stop it there for now. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for your support. Remember, you can get extra episodes by becoming a patron or joining this channel if you are listening on YouTube. You get all kinds of extra content, including extra episodes, author chats, and mini courses, as well as other cool perks. So thank you in advance for that. I appreciate you. I appreciate your time. I appreciate you listening, and I will be back again very shortly.
Blow, northern wind, scent will make me sweating. Blow, northern wind, blow, blow, blow. Ich hot a board in Bauerbrick, at solis semlis on sich. Men's cool maiden of nicht fairen freight of wonder. In all this warfliche one, board of blood and of